are you calling bums, pal?
You!
Randy!
Listen, we got two more of us in the back seat.
Pity the back seat.
If you're looking for a fight.
I am looking for a fight!
Come on, put
Let's go! Come on, right now!
Come
right
on! Now.
All right, well, here we are. I am not Jimmy Ferrari, but I am hosting the Delta Bravo Urban Exploration Team podcast called Mission Statements. I have been fortunate enough to be a guest in the past. I'm Andy Katz, and I am in Maryland, the United States, and I have two guests with me today, one of which is a photographer, and another one who is a director and a video editor. And we are in a lot of different time zones. Nick Light is here from Vancouver, Canada. At least that's where he is right now. He's not originally from Vancouver. And we have David Corio, legendary photographer. And I want to make sure that I pulled from your website, David, and I thought I would sort of read a formal introduction of who you are, and you can kind of correct me if I'm wrong or kind of add to it. Yeah. But this is David Corio was born in London, England in 1960. He began his professional career in 1978, taking photographs for New Musical Express. By the way, I had no idea that was what NME stood for. That was kind of cool to read that. Followed by The Face, Time Out, and Black Echoes, covering a wide range of music and portraiture. After a stint as a music writer at City Limits, he worked as a freelance photographer for The Daily Telegraph, The Times, Hew, Theatre Royal Stratford, and Greensleeves Records, among others. Now, there was more to that bio, but I'm going to sort of let you fill in some of the blanks. And right. I wanted to, I'm just really excited that you were willing to meet with us today and share a little bit about your photography. And then also maybe we'll touch on how you and I came to know one another a little bit as well. So welcome, David Corio, legendary photographer.
Nice to be here. So do you want any more of a fill-in then on the bio? Or
my first question was really just so you've been doing this for a while. I guess I dated you already by telling everyone.
Right. Yes, yeah, giving me age away, yeah.
But how did you get started as a photographer?
I was so lucky. I got into photography really when I was about 13, 14. And I was lucky my sister, I went to art school when I was 16. So I did, they have, over here in England anyway, night schools where it's like vocational schools to go to of an evening just to learn a subject. So I did photography there when I was about 15, sort of just one evening a week, you know, and sort of really got into that. But on the strength of that, I got into, or with the help of that anyway, got into art school when I was 16. So that was, you know, young by standards here anyway. And so I did like a course in photography for 2 years at college. And in the meantime, my sister got engaged to a guy called Reckless Eric, who was a sort of budding musician who just signed for Stiff Records, what was then a sort of starting up record label. And I got quite a few breaks there. They'd just signed Elvis Costello and The Damned and Nick Cave. So it's punk, new wave sort of music, you know. But so I sort of got in with a few people then, and, you know, it really sort of mushroomed from there. And I was back in London when I was sort of 18 and just started. NME was like the sort of music Bible, certainly over here. So I was trying to sort of get in with them. So I started to shoot gigs and just give them sort of prints and, you know, different photographs. And eventually, you know, they started giving me work. So it really sort of mushroomed from there. And then, you know, whatever music was coming along, I was sort of trying to jump in on. So that was sort of the time of punk and new wave, certainly over here. And then early hip hop, you know, the first hip hop coming to England was really 1981, 82, when Grandmaster Flash came over, and then Bambaataa, and, you know, a few different sort of hip hop sort of packages started coming. So so it was good to, you know, sort of catch up on music in the early stages of, you know, different music sort of movements, really, you know.
There's a story I think I heard you tell, I think on another podcast. I listened to the Let Christy Take It podcast.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
You were explaining how there was a time where you were trying to get into a festival and ended up sleeping under a truck or.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Tent. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah. That was Reading Festival. It was like a really big music festival over here. And it was sort of just at the stage when punk was and sort of different music was just beginning to sort of, you know, get a bit of a presence anyway. And the lineup was a real mixture of Thin Lizzy, Aerosmith, Doobie Brothers, Hawkwind, but also Wayne County, who was like, you know, early. Jane County, it was Wayne County then, and then became Jane County. So there was sort of quite a lot going on. He then got bottled off the stage within about sort of 20 seconds of coming up. Punk wasn't liked by those sort of crowds, but I managed to hop. I found a hole in the fence basically, and I sort of got in without sort of paying, and I had the cameras, and I managed to get backstage, but I thought, you know, I'm not going to be able to get out. If I go out again, I'm going to get caught, you know, and get thrown out because I didn't have a ticket or anything. So I thought I'll just have to stay backstage, and the only place to sort of shelter was, you know, sleep lying under the tour buses. So I found out afterwards I was under John Peel's tour bus. John Peel was very influential music radio DJ over here anyway. So that was a good experience. That was when I was 16 or 17. So I think, you know, that probably gave me the music bug, you know, or certainly helped anyway.
That's the late 70s, is that right?
Yeah, that was 77, I think it was, yeah. So I guess I just turned 17. So yeah, that was sort of early days anyway. So, but you know, I wouldn't do it now, but you know, back then it was, you know, you felt more take a risk, you know, what's going to happen? You're only just going to get thrown out, you know? So that's probably the worst that could happen. So.
And then what happened was you ended up somehow attaching yourself to reggae and Jamaican artists. How did that unfold? How did that happen?
Yeah, I've always sort of had a real love for reggae. I mean, still buying reggae today, actually. But I think it's probably different to the States or a lot of the States anyway. You know, London's always had a big sort of Jamaican population since you know, the 50s, really. So I grew up with Jamaican people, you know, neighbors and stuff in London, and then when I went to college, I was in Gloucester, and that's had a big Jamaican population as well. So you'd hear reggae on the radio and, you know, on the street a lot. So it wasn't sort of something that unusual, you know, and I just really sort of loved that music. So I guess, well, I shot Bob Marley in 1980 and a few other reggae artists before that. And, you know, it just sort of clicked, really. So that's sort of probably the music that I've you know, stuck with predominantly, really. I mean, I cover, you know, all sorts of music, particularly, you know, black music, hip hop, jazz, R&B, but reggae is probably my true love anyway, you know, so.
And speaking of Bob Marley, there was a story about how you managed to shoot him at a festival as well. There was a lake involved, I believe.
Yes, yeah, that's Crystal Palace in London, South London. There's it's like a natural amphitheater, but they've got a stage, and right in front of the stage is a lake. And so the only way to get sort of close to the front of the stage was to sort of wade into the lake, you know. So there were quite a few people in the water already. Thankfully, it was in the summer, so it wasn't so bad, but. So, yeah, there was me and one other photographer that I know of that we sort of waded in. So I was up to about in between sort of waist and chest deep, you know.
Just holding your camera.
Yeah, I took a plastic carrier bag. I had my camera in the carrier bag with a couple of rolls of film, you know. So it's the first time I'd ever sort of loaded a camera, you know, sort of like up here, you know, making sure not to drop the roll of film or whatever, you know. But so yeah, but I managed to get some good shots out of it. So, you know, it was worth it. But yeah, Joe Jackson, who was on the bill earlier, someone in the water found a dead duck, and they threw it at Joe Jackson while he was on stage, and it hit him right in the chest. And fairly understandably, he sort of walked off in disgust anyway, you know. So but yeah, that, you know, I guess it's worse than being bottled off by, you know, getting a dead duck thrown at you. But still, so.
Poor Joe Jackson. So he never played that show? He never came back out?
He didn't come back on, no. I think he did about 2-3 numbers, you know, and that was it. So
I love Joe Jackson, too. Like, that would have been.
Oh, you did? Yeah. Well, he did a bit of reggae production as well, actually. He produced a few good reggae tunes, actually, for other people. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and Nick, you can jump in here too whenever you feel like it. I one of the ways that you and I kind of ended up getting connected, David, was through this Delta Bravo thing. I ended up going to the UK in 2019, and one of my goals then was to find these beautiful pictures of Public Enemy in Hyde Park.
Right.
And I knew your photos, but I didn't know you. And so I went and I found these, I was excited because I found these spots where Public Enemy was standing on this kind of, this footpath on the north edge of Hyde Park. And I just managed to match up a building sort of through the woods. And I was pretty sure, and then when I got there, I was very sure I was in the right spot. But I wasn't feeling all that great about it until I posted it. And unsolicited, I'd put your name on it. I had tagged you on it. And you said, you know, bravo, you did it. Like, you found the exact spot. And sort of that was a really nice connection for me as somebody who, I need that validation. I need that sort of 100% sure I'm in the right spot. But also the blessing of the photographer, too. And so that happened a couple of times before I actually met you in person, which I think emboldened me to introduce myself to you in person. The other one, and this is the long way of asking this question, is another one that I found of yours was the Foo Fighters in Lower Manhattan. And I think you lived there for a while, right? And what brought you to New York, and how long were you there?
Yeah, I lived in New York for 16 years. So I moved over. First time I ever went to New York was 1981. I came across hip hop stuff then, actually, early breakdancers anyway. And then I sort of visited quite a few times work-wise, for different music papers. And then basically England was, it was just sort of crap in the early 90s. Similar to how it is now, actually, you know, there were lots of strikes, there was very little work, and I had friends in New York, so I came over in 91 to see if I could get some, you know, freelance work. And quite a few people said yes. So I sort of just made the, sort of took the risk anyway of, you know, deciding to move over. Didn't have any legal documents or anything, but I'd sort of blagged it. And I got work from the New York Times. So they started giving me work through a connection at Tommy Boy, actually. So I was lucky, but I was illegal. I didn't have a social security number or anything. And so it was a bit dodgy sort of working for them. But they were okay about it, actually, at the time. So I think it would have been a lot tougher now. But so I lived in Manhattan, lived on Thompson Street between Prince and Spring in Soho, and then moved to the West Village. And yeah, we lived there for 16 years. So it was good. So I worked mainly for the New York Times and other, you know, Village Voice and other sort of, and also the Times over here quite a lot. So, and that was where I linked up with quite a few reggae labels in particular, and some hip hop stuff as well, you know, while in New York. I mean, I knew people before in London, but, you know, I sort of linked up, certainly met quite a lot of other people there, you know, but yeah, it was good. You know, I mean, I'm sort of glad I did. I've got dual citizenship and everything now, so that's quite useful, you know, but I sort of I felt New York was running out of steam a bit, you know, but I left in 2008 and it was just getting so gentrified. It sort of lost its, you know, cutting edge of it, I thought, you know. So,
and there's a lot of people that would agree with you. It's safer and it's maybe cleaner, but it there's a lot of people who feel that way about certain neighborhoods are just not.
Yeah. I was in the West Village, I mean, it was sort of fairly gentrified anyway, but it was when our local deli became a chocolatière, and then our local laundrette became a Marc Jacobs sunglasses shop. You know, it was like, you know, time to get out, and everyone was, you know, going out to wear a suit, you know, to go out of an evening, and it's like, that's not me, you know. So and there were, you know, family things and that I needed to deal with here, but it was good, you know, while I was there, certainly. But, you know, nice to visit, but I think, you know, I prefer London, I think, now.
So one of the things that I started to realize as I was running down all of these locations in the United States is that I kept coming across the name David Corio. I found one of my favorite pictures of De La Soul. They're standing in front of the Apollo Theater. And sure enough, there's your name attached to that. And so I realized pretty quickly that a lot of my favorite images were images that you took. And so I guess that brings us to last summer in June, we planned another trip out to the UK. And I just threw caution to the wind and thought, well, the worst he's going to do is say no. But I cold called you, basically. I sent you, I think I using your email address from your website, I wrote this note saying, hey, I'm Andy Katz and I'm coming out. I'm really determined to find the spots that you took of Cold Chillin', the Juice Crew. And I felt pretty good about that. I found it on Kensington High Street. Didn't know what Kensington High Street was, but I found this little connector path between the high street and the court. And I pressed send and hoped that I would hear back from you. And to your credit, you were so nice about it. You said, hey, like, yeah, sure, we can connect. And I thought, this is going to be great. I'll just have like a 10-minute conversation with David and get to know him and tell him a little bit about what we do and how your photography has inspired so many people and how we can kind of run down these spots now, whether it's from a movie or a favorite photo or an old magazine. And then the guy that's on our call, Nick Light, I told him, I'm like, hey, David said he'd meet me. And he's like, okay, well.
Well, there's two things. I was supposed to be in London for that exact
day. You were supposed to be there. You were supposed to meet us. That's right.
Yeah. Because I'd been booked for a job for 2 months. So I was supposed to have been in London, and I made sure I had that day off. And then the job got pushed and eventually got cancelled. So I wasn't going to be in London. But I didn't want to let this opportunity kind of like go by. So I immediately got in touch with a few camera people that I know who are all busy. It was very busy over the summer. So I put out a post on one of the kind of like filmmaking forums, and I came across the two guys that came down to film me. Tim, who I've since hired 4 or 5 times since you filmed that thing with him. And was it Anton?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Anton. Yeah. Anyway, the other guy. Anton, don't include that in the podcast. Yeah, they came to, you know, I looked over their work. Tim, I knew, had directed stuff as well. So that means Tim just kind of like sat down and wrote like a, you know, this is kind of how I would be directing this if I was actually in London right now. You know, we kind of went through and we kind of bounced ideas around. Fortunately, we'd already made In Search of Run DMC by that point. So we had like a good idea. You know, he kind of knew that if you pointed out a photograph, then I was kind of like, right, then you need to make sure you get like the photograph on Andy's phone or in the book that you had, David, just so we can put together these stories in the way that we wanted. However, because I work in television for a living, it's what I've done since 2014. So my mind kind of just goes straight to like, all right, I'll get two camera guys, we'll get sound, we'll get X, Y, and Z. And I know that Andy was a bit concerned because he didn't want to scare you away.
I was on my family vacation, right? And he's like, oh, we'll mic him up. We'll send videographers. I'm like, I was so glad he said he would meet me. I don't want to scare him off. You know me? I'm a total stranger. And then I'm going to show up in a place I've never been with two videographers who I don't know and ask somebody to get mic'd up. And then David, again, to his credit, was like, sure. I'm like, no problem. Let's do it. And it was so efficient, by the way. Everybody showed up exactly when they should. It was 2 p.m. I was about an hour early because I'm a worrywart. So I ended up getting there way too early. And I ended up going for a walk. And I was so jet lagged and so tired when I got back. I was like, oh, that was a bad idea to go for a walk. But sure enough, Anton and Tim showed up. And they had all their gear and they showed up exactly at 2. And I was making small talk. I was like, well, this is really great. How long have you known Nick? And they're like, we don't know Nick. And I was like, well, how long have you known each other? And they're like, we don't know each other. And I realized how naive I was that this is just how it works when you're a professional. Because I was just there doing what we do as Delta Bravo, kind of running down these spots. And you all were doing what you really do, this for a job. And you're all professionals. So I was in awe of how professional everybody was and how accommodating David was. And David,
I'm supposed to be on the other side of the camera, I must say, but
yeah, me too. Trust me. But do you remember there was a gentleman there that was a little worried about our situation? He was and you explained to me that we were standing in the middle of this very posh neighborhood and that there were some Russian oligarchs that had lived there and there was some kind of upheaval where somebody had been forced to leave and that sort of thing. Do you remember?
Yeah. That was, I think it was where I'd shot Marley Marl and MC Shan, and there was like some security guard, large sort of security guy sort of came up, didn't he? And I think he was sort of, I guess, seeing the cameras, whether he was concerned that they were going to be filming his, you know, his client or whatever. But it's a very wealthy neighborhood around there. There's a lot of, you see a lot of, I guess, sort of, seems to be sort of, you know, Middle Eastern guys with very fancy Ferraris and Lamborghinis and God knows what else. You know, and there's big money there. You know, I mean, it's where there certainly were a lot of oligarchs, whether they're still there in hiding or have left now, I don't know. But yeah, there's it's not for the poor, certainly, that neighborhood. So a bit incongruous to have those hip hop guys there, really, but they were the office for the record company was sort of just up the alleyway, as I pointed out when we met up. But
Yeah. So, you know, I was going to talk more about the bouncer guy. I think he was sent out to the street by his boss. But really, what's more important is what we were doing there. Your photos from 1988. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Juice Crew, Marley Marl, MC Shan, Big Daddy Kane, and Biz Markie. And for those of you, even if you're not a hip hop fan, I mean, I'm a big hip hop fan, but not everybody in the Delta Bravo group is as much into hip hop as other genres. But if you've seen a picture of Biz Markie, it was likely taken that day by David. And when he passed away, they used his imagery over and over again, because you got this amazing collection of images of him. And can you speak to that a little bit? I know in our little documentary that's coming out, you go into some detail, but for those of you who haven't heard this story before, could you just speak about what you remember?
I was shooting for a black music paper, weekly newspaper called Black Echoes, and there you go. You actually have, is that the copy, is that the actual issue? God, I haven't got that. Anyway, haven't seen that in over 20 years. Oh wow, well done. God, they didn't use the best picture, but that's typical of them.
That's what I mean. I knew what you were saying. It's a picture that's seen the least amount of daylight of Biz Markie.
Right, yeah. Wow, okay. And that's nice to see, anyway. Basically I was given, they were being interviewed at what was WEA Records, and the offices were down this sort of alleyway just off High Street, Kensington, and I was told I had to do like four individual portraits of each of the four, and I had like half an hour to shoot all four of them, which I mean, I'd shoot quickly, but that is, you know, pushing it basically. So but Biz Markie was the first one. And I, to be honest, I wasn't really sort of particularly up on any of their music. I mean, I knew of Biz Markie, but I wasn't such a big hip hop fan that I knew his stuff that well. So I didn't really know what to expect. And he came out with these sort of rope chains on, and he just was brilliant. I mean, for me, you know, he was just so easy to photograph, because every time, this is sort of back when cameras had film in them, it was you get 36 shots on a roll of film, or can squeeze 37 normally if you're lucky. And each shot I took, he would be pulling another pose without me really asking at all. So he was strangling himself with his rope chains, and someone had parked a BMW in this little street, and he just climbed on top of the hood of the car, and was just posing on top of this BMW, and then just sort of jumped off of it. So he was, every shot was a money shot, basically. You know, it was just, I had a wide angle lens. I was probably about 2 inches away from his face, and he was, you know, sort of hamming it up. And that worked out really well. And
David and me and Andy were talking about is, so when I was doing research into this, and I was looking on Getty Images, I was explaining to Andy the reason I was looking on Getty's, because a lot of the like websites that kind of reuse your images, they tend to modify the image slightly. They crush they kind of like boost the contrast or something. So I wanted to go back. I wanted the images that you submitted, essentially.
Yeah.
When I was looking for the Biz Markie ones on Getty, I realized how many additional photographs that you took of him that I hadn't ever seen. There were certain pictures in there, I was like, I've never seen that picture before, but there was just something so amazing about it. And you're exactly right, because every single picture, he's pulling a face, or he's throwing a pose, or he's doing something.
Yeah. I mean, literally, you know, that was one roll of film. I probably got at least sort of 20 over, normally if you got sort of maybe three good pictures out of a roll of film, you know, on the average, 3 or 4, you'd think, you know, you did pretty well out of it. But with that, I would say I probably got at least 20, you know.
So when your images went on to Getty, sorry, Andy, if I'm jumping into it. When you submitted them, did you submit them yourself to Getty, or did you have like an agent that did it? So I'm kind of curious why you decided to submit so many additional ones of Bismarck Heat, essentially.
Right. I do it all myself. It's a way of getting them out there. I mean, they, you know, Getty have a much wider potential market than I do. You know, I mean, people come to me, but I mean, those images have been pirated more than like any of my photographs, I can assure you. You know, the amount of t-shirts and stuff I see with those pictures on, you know, but that happens, you know, if it gets published in a magazine or a paper, you know, someone can take them, you know, easily. I mean, they've been on quite a few record sleeves that I've never, you know, been contacted about. Certainly never been paid or credited, you know, but I mean, you've got to get used to that and not feel so precious over it, because it will just do your head in if you, you know. I know people that are searching eBay all the time for their photographs, you know, and it's like, you've just got to give up on it to an extent, you know. I mean, if it's a big company that steals your image, then, you know, I'd go for them, you know, but you know, when it's little sort of dibby little, you know, sort of companies, that's, you've got to just let it go, I think, you know.
So you can't keep the ownership of the images then. It's not like they're owned by Echoes, for example, if they commission.
No. Copyright law with photography is the copyright belongs to the photographer. So even if I was to shoot, you know, say I was shooting him for a record company for a specific sleeve or whatever, it's still my copyright. And I can do really whatever I want with the pictures, unless you sign an agreement, you know, to say it's a buyout or anything like that. The trouble is, the problem is, when it comes to merchandise, that's when it's really then the artist or the artist's estate has to give you permission, you know, to, like, if you wanted to put it on a t-shirt or a coffee mug or something, then you need permission from the estate, because you're using that person's likeness to make money. So, you know, it's a bit different. Whereas, you know, if it was on the cover of a magazine, it's, people would buy that magazine regardless of what's on the cover. So it's, but yeah, photo copyright law is different in different countries as well. So it creates problems, you know. I mean, I had to sue the Gap once, soon after I moved to New York, and that was major grief.
What image did they use?
They used an image, theoretically, I'm sort of signed a contract to be totally silent and never mentioned before.
Okay.
But regardless, anyway, it was a jazz musician, not well-known jazz musician from Newark, and she had alopecia, so she was totally bald, had no hair, no physical hair at all, and it was her and her boyfriend, who will remain nameless because he is a name, basically. But and I, unbeknownst to me, they gave the pictures to the Gap, and suddenly I discovered my photographs on sort of bus stands and in Grand Central Station and everything. And so that was when I sued them for, that was breach of copyright. And it was a federal offense. It became a big deal, which I couldn't really sustain. So it went on for like 18 months, and we had to settle in the end for a lot less. But, you know, that's lawsuits with big companies for you. You know, I mean, it's sometimes you can't win, you know?
Well, this is kind of a good segue, I think, for what I wanted to bring up next, which was, you know, how do you, as a photographer, a working photographer, someone who's been doing this for a really long time, when someone like me comes along or who's all enthusiastic about your work in sort of this different way, a non-commercial way, how did you feel when I reached out to contact you about visiting the space and visiting this spot? And this is just one shoot in a really storied career. How did that make you feel?
Yeah. Oh no. I'm sort of certainly open on the whole to, you know, I mean, I get people asking me that are starting up doing photography, you know, to give them advice or whatever. And, you know, I don't mind that at all. You know, it's not, you know, it's nice to sort of help out a bit where you can. And, you know, it's no great loss if, you know, if I didn't have that much on that day or whatever, then, you know, that's fine. So, and it was what was really nice was actually revisiting those locations, because I hadn't been there, you know, since I'd taken the pictures. So however many years that was, you know, over 30 years ago anyway. So, so it was, you know, and it was nice. I mean, you really sort of reminded me of a lot of sort of stories and things that I'd, you know, sort of either blanked out or just sort of forgotten about, you know. So, and revisiting those locations, you know, made me realize how, you know, what a small space it was. Yeah. And you know, so how, well, it also reminded me of how much you know, as a photographer like that, you're shooting on the fly, you know, you're not using hair or makeup, or, you know, I never use an assistant or anything. So I'm, you know, literally not using lights, I'm not using reflectors or anything. So, you know, literally it's depends on the weather of the day and everything. I mean, that shoot, the Bismarcky, and then I did Big Daddy Kane and MC Shan and Marley Marr. It was a grey, really sort of typical London overcast sort of grey day, you know, which it wasn't when we met up. But that weather, for me, I think is the best sort of weather for shooting. I was always shooting black and white film then, and particularly for black skin, that sort of, it's almost like it's not quite twilight, but, you know, I mean, it was, I probably did the shoot at, I don't know, 2 p.m. or something, but the light was so bad, you know, the amount of daylight was so bad, but you actually get a real sort of richness when you're sort of shooting in black and white. So, and particularly with sort of black skin as well, you tend to, or I would anyway, if you're exposing for the darkness of the sort of skin complexion, you blow out all the highlights behind them. So I think that's what the reason some of those pictures really stand out is, you know, Bismarcky really stands out in those pictures, because the background is all out of focus and, you know, bleached out totally. And the same with the, particularly with the Big Daddy Kane as well, that, you know, just on a technical level, you know, it was a good shoot, you know, when you're getting a good shot, basically. I mean, I knew straight away with Biz, you know, that he was really easy. Typical characters are very different, because Big Daddy Kane was the total opposite. I mean, he was,
yeah,
you know, 5 or 6 shots and you knew, you know, he was done, basically, you know. So
back to what I was saying before, you know, I was saying that all the images I was Googling, they'd all been kind of modified from your original picture. Now, listening to what you were just saying there about, like, how you're working with the light and that location, all that kind of stuff, that's why it annoys me that people would kind of take the image and go, oh, I need to crush the blacks a little bit here because I think it looked better. That's why I'm always like, I want to see the picture you took, because you put that thought and time into when you were taking the picture. You might have been like quick thoughts over the course of 20 seconds of just like, okay, the background's a bit like this, blah, blah, blah. But it's unfair to kind of look at your pictures when they've been reframed, or like I said, they've had the lightness or darkness or contrast or something kind of modified, because what I want photographs of the horrible folk.
Yeah, those Bismarcky ones in particular have been really I would say butchered, but I mean, there's the ones that are colorized in particular, you know, when they try and, it's not hand tint, but it looks like sort of hand tint in the, you know, trying to make the skin color what they think the actual color would have been, or then. There's a few of those Biz ones where they use like horrible blue and yellow and, you know, try and make his rope change. They just put yellow on the chain. You know, it's like, it never works, I don't think. You know, I mean, I've always liked the old school black and white film and be done with it, you know. But it's, I know what you mean. It's hard to convince some people. I think, you know, some designers feel they've got to do something to, you know, manipulate or put their stamp on an image, you know, just to make it maybe fit their sort of criteria. But it doesn't, I don't think it normally helps, you know, but it's hard to argue with designers sometimes.
So can I ask sort of maybe a typical question about your career? Do you have the most memorable or favorite shoot that you've done? And then, and I think I know the answer to the second part, is do you have one that where the person you were shooting was being really difficult and not so cooperative?
the Bob Marley shoot was certainly one of my, I mean, I got some great pictures out of that. I mean, as well as the Bismarcky, I think, you know, is definitely up there, and the Public Enemy as well. That was another shoot where it was just, you know, pretty much every frame was a winner, you know. It was slightly different because there were, you know, seven of them or something, so six or seven. So, you know, that's a different problem in trying to get everyone concentrating. George Clinton's another one who I would put up there as one of my favorites to photograph, certainly. He was again, like Biz, sort of like pulling poses like all the time, and was just a real laugh, you know, I mean, to shoot. And but I asked him whether he still took drugs, and as George had a reputation in his earlier days with, you know, Parliament and Funkadelic, and he said, it's very seriously, he said, only when I'm working, and I'm working all the time. And it's like, all right, cheers, George, you know.
Great. So,
he was good. He had sort of bright red false eyelashes and multicolored braided hair, and, you know, about 50 necklaces on, and so yeah, he was good to shoot. Again, I only shot in black and white, which typical, was such a colorful thing.
There's a really good, you said this in the documentary, but I think it's worth saying out the podcast as well, there's a very good reason as to why you shot black and white,
right? Yeah,
consider it these days. But the reason you said in the documentary is obviously because they're being published in newspapers, which are printing in black and white. So why waste the amount of time it takes for you to develop a color image, right? There's so much going on there that it would just be.
Yeah. It was also economics as well, because, I mean, like that, the paper you've got there, the Black Echoes, they would pay £8 for a picture. So, which is probably now what? Well, then it was like, would be about $12 a picture that was published, but they weren't paying any expenses at all. So like for that, so if you think, you know, that shoot, if they use three or four pictures, you know, I'd be lucky to be clearing probably $20 profit at the most, you know. So, so it wasn't a particularly lucrative, you know, sort of line of work. I was shooting a lot for them. I mean, I was doing one or two jobs a day with a bit of luck, you know, but then you'd have to go home, develop the film, print the pictures, deliver the pictures. and they might use one, you know, or two. So it was sort of like, I mean, it's worked out. It was a good investment, you know, over the long haul. But at that actual time, a roll of color film was just too expensive, you know, to shoot. I mean, so it was literally down, which was why that, you know, out of those four, Beers and Big Daddy Kane, I was shooting like half a roll of film with most of them, just because it was like, you know, why take 36 shots if you know you've got it in 15 or something, you know, save a roll and save yourself, you know, $10 or something, you know. So I mean, it might seem cheapskate, but it was, you know, that was the freelance, well, yeah, how the freelance lifestyle was then, you know. So it was, you know, counting the pennies, literally, you know. But
just to finish up talking about black and white, is there any pictures you took, and I feel that you'd probably say the George Clinton one, but is there any pictures you took that were black and white that you wish you took in colour in retrospect?
Yeah. I mean, certainly that is probably that one. I mean, and also some of the Bob Marley. I mean, he was wearing a red, golden, green jacket, which, you know, is various shades of grey in the black and white shots. There's quite a few that I wish I'd shot both colour and black and white. But there's something, I think, I mean, for shooting black and white, you can put your own stamp on it, on an image, I think, a lot more, you know, in your own style of photography. You know, people can, I think, you know, identify your work a lot better as a black and white image. Then, you know, a color image can be like, oh, you know, half a dozen people could have taken that, you know. But I think you can create your own style a bit more with, you know, shooting black and white. Because I always print my own pictures as well. So, you know, it's the actual taking the pictures is only, you know, half of it in some ways. It's then, you know, getting in the darkroom and, you know, manipulating the print a bit as well. So, which, I mean, I do, you know, quite a lot. So, you know, just emphasize bits, burn, make things a bit darker or lighter. And, you know, it just sort of creates a bit more, it becomes a bit more personal, I think, you know, and sort of tactile. And then, well, going back to your story, Andy, about the worst person I've Thank photographed, you. that has got to go to what used to be quite a musical hero of mine, but Ray Davis of the Kinks, best known for being in the Kinks. Him along with actually Phil Collins as well, who
really
is another, yeah, quick one for Phil Collins. I went to where was I, Cologne in Germany to photograph him in when they were, he was in Genesis, and I traveled there by sort of train, boat, and then another train, and got there, and he didn't like the journalist because the journalist had reviewed one of his albums and not given it a glowing review. So we got there backstage, and he told us to F off, and really? It was like, oh, thanks, you know, just traveled 500 miles to see your crappy band, and he wouldn't let us do the interview or anything, you know. So he's up there, but Ray Davis was definitely the worst. I actually saw him a couple of weeks ago on the street, but it was for the Times, the London Times, and I was shooting him, and he was being totally secretive about where he was. He lives in or near Highgate in North London, and so they told me to sort of choose some locations to shoot him at. So I sort of took pictures. This is now I'm shooting digital, so I took sort of pictures with a digital camera of a few alleyways and cobbled streets and stuff, and I met up with him eventually and showed him the pictures, and he said, no, I don't like that, and no, I don't like that. He didn't like any of the locations at all. And then he suggested the square, which is quite a popular, you know, you get a lot of people walking through it, and it's like, I don't mind, you know, but I just thought for you, you know, do you want to be posing with people wandering around past you, you know? So we sort of went there, and he had, his hair was like very thin, and it was dyed like a eggplant color, you know. It was like a really weird sort of purpley color, and he had huge flakes of dandruff that were like the size of cornflakes. I mean, it was like ridiculous, not only in his hair and scalp, but on his shoulders and everything, you know. And so I go, I take a picture, and he goes, oh, can I have a look? And it's like, yeah, okay. So I show him, you know, digital camera, back of the camera. He goes, oh, I don't like that, delete that. So I delete it. And then I take another picture. He goes, can I have a look? It's like, for God's sake, man. And this just went on and on. I was just like, every frame I took, he wanted to see it. And I ended up, you know, normally with digital, I'd shoot, you know, 150 or more pictures, you know, which is probably small for compared to a lot of photographers. And but with him, he just made me delete. In the end, I had, I think I got about 16 pictures that he was sort of happy with or claimed to be happy with. So I sent them to the Time, edit, you know, sort of cleaned them up a bit. Well, I had to retouch them all because of all his dandruff all over his jacket. And then I sent them to the Times, and then I got a phone call, told the picture editor what a pain in the neck he was. And then she called me back about an hour later saying, oh, you'll never guess. I just got a phone call from Ray Davis saying that he wants to see all the pictures again before any of them get published. And I said, oh, you know, what did you say? And she said, oh, I just told him to F off, which I was very pleased that she had said that, because, you know, it was like.
So they ended up printing them after all.
Yeah, they used one. Yeah. So, I mean, but, you know, it was just like, what? I mean, I don't know, you know, what is it, ego or just sort of like vanity or what? But I mean, he's not the greatest looking guy in the first place, you know. So, I mean, and you would think by now he must have seen enough bad photographs of himself, right. You know. But, so, yeah, I would certainly put Ray up there at the top, I think, of the pain in the neck charts anyway.
Outstanding. Oh, my gosh, that's great. So, listen, I know I want to be sensitive to your time. I know that you have other things on your schedule. Yeah. I wanted to ask, I guess, a little bit of a personal question. I'm somebody, just if I'm sitting in my little studio here in my house, and a lot of my artwork is, well, I would say most of my artwork is based on not only my favorite musicians, but my favorite photographers' work. And sort of, I'm sort of at the mercy of good photographers to give me sort of subject and composition that I love. But I also understand I'm copying someone else's work. And I wonder, do you have a feeling about that one way or the other? Because I did, even before I met you, I had drawn from some of your photography. I drew a Bismarcky portrait that I brought to Bismarcky in person when he was still alive. And he signed the drawing that I did, but it was from the photo shoot that you and I right. talked yeah. about. So yeah. How do you feel about that?
I don't mind. I mean, on the whole, it's a tricky one. I mean, it's a sensitive subject for a lot of people, and you know, a lot of photographers and artists, obviously. As long as I always feel, you know, if it's just sort of going on, you know, if it's like a personal thing or it's going to be on, you know, someone's social media or whatever, you know, I don't have a problem with it. Whenever I see people that have used my work or as a source, you know, material, I normally ask them, you know, can you at least, you know, attribute the, you know, where you got the image from, you know, not necessarily on the front of the painting or drawing or whatever, but at least at the, you know, on the back, or you know, give some credit to where you got the image source from. So on that level, you know, I'm not I don't mind. It's, you know, if it's then used commercially, that's when I sort of have a problem. You know, if someone's, you know, obviously I don't mind you giving it to Biz or whatever, but, you know, if it was to suddenly appear on a billboard, you know, then I would like, hang on a minute, you know.
Sure.
And I've had a clash with a couple of people who have done, you know, specifically an artist who she does paintings on the reggae. She's basically does portraits, but she sort of copies people's photographs, and they're photorealist paintings. You know, they're not, she hasn't done anything other than directly copied it. And she claimed ignorance when I sort of contacted her about it, because she's selling them on her website and and everything. And when I contacted her, she was, you know, was pleading total ignorance, that she didn't know that they were my photographs, and which I knew was bull, basically, because she took, they were on my website and a lot of them weren't anywhere else, you know. So, and she had, I think she painted probably about 14 or 15 of my pictures, you know. So it's like, you know, one off, or, you know, if it's someone you can understand, it's a mistake. But if someone has basically gone alphabetically through my website and, you know, sort of, oh, here's, you know, Burning Spear, I'll paint him, you know, oh, here's Bob Marley, you know, whatever, then, you know, that's when I get peeved, you know. Sure.
And this is why I was asking, is that I find you to be sort of a unicorn in that you're very accommodating with your time, and you met us, and you also let us interview you today, and you're very transparent about how you feel about different things, and that isn't always how it is. We've had this group of Delta Bravo where we go and we find these different locations. We're really trying to honor the photography and honor the photographer. And so whenever we can, we attribute the photos, and we always share the address, and we always try to encourage people to go look at more of that photographer's work. So it's good to hear that while you're protective, you're also open to these kind of conversations, because
you
can sort of shut down by some other people. Some other people are like, you know, take that off. I don't want you to.
Oh, really? And I mean, some people, you know, I mean, I don't really understand why, you know, people get so precious sometimes over their stuff. And it's like, well, you know, surely I feel, you know, it's good for people to be able to see the work, you know, and, you know, as long as it gets sort of, you know, if your name is attached or credited or something, then, you know, if it just broadens, you know, it's a way of broadening your own base, and also, you know, bring in, you know, hopefully a bit of enjoyment, you know, to other people, or a wider audience, you know. But yeah, I guess, you know, you always get some people, don't you? I mean, in film as well, Nick, you know, I'm sure you know that people can get very precious over stuff, you know. And it's like, well, you know, I think it's good to be as open as possible, you know.
So let me do this real quick. I'm wearing my Brooklyn sweatshirt. I'm not in Brooklyn, but I wanted to kind of give a head nod to Jimmy Ferrari, the normal podcast host of Mission Statements. And I asked him if I should throw out the sponsors, and he assured me that I should. So I just want to make mention of some of the people that support this podcast, and they're actually members of this group. So they're not only own their own businesses and run their own businesses, they go out and they meet photographers and they hit spots and they also explore, which is what we're all about, really. So one of them is Main Street Jukebox. I think that's in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. It's owned and operated by Tom Lefevre. I think that's the right way to say his last name. And Main Street Jukebox, it's probably about 3.5 hours from where I live. And I want to get up there sometime and buy some records. It seems like he's got an incredible shop up there. And then the other three sponsors are Percival Eats, Percival Pub, and the Ashburn Pub. all owned and operated by Kevin Bednarz, who's a friend of mine and also a member of Delta Bravo and the MCA Day crew, the people that put on MCA Day. So just really fantastic people who've also been guests on this podcast. So if you haven't heard their episodes, go back into the archives and listen to them. It's really kind of amazing to have David on here as sort of a building block of what we're trying to accomplish, just sharing our stories of exploration and going out and kind of throwing caution to the wind. I'm not usually so outgoing as I would introduce myself to someone I don't know very well, but I figured I'd take a chance. And thank you, David, for not laughing in my face and meeting a total stranger with some cameras and some microphones, you know?
Right. No, not at all. No. I tell you, there was something I wanted to ask. It's a picture I took of the grave diggers in New York.
That's right.
And I've been trying to find the actual location myself again, because I know it was, I'm sure it was just off of West Broadway, south of Canal Street. So if people know New York, it's a picture of, it was like, it was used as a publicity picture by G Street Records, but they're in a little sort of dead end alleyway, and it was off of, I'm sure it was either West Broadway or one of those streets, in little alleyways in Tribeca. And I don't know, what do you use Google Maps, or how do you
anything and everything? Google Maps is a great way to do it. Sometimes just using a search and finding other pictures from the same photo shoot can help. Talking to people that are in the picture has often helped.
Right. Yeah, that helped.
But I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm so glad you brought that up, because you had mentioned that when we met. And people in this group are going to try to find that now.
I was going to say, in New York, by the way, there's like a Google Maps, which is of like older photographs. So it's obviously not as complete as like, you know, dropping yourself on a pin. But I used it when I was when we were working on In Search of Run DMC. I came across it then. Andy, I think I sent it to you, because I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. So you can kind of like walk down the streets in the way that Andy does on Google, but you're able to look at like old photographs that were kind of like taken.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's good.
No, I'm so glad you remembered to throw down that gauntlet, because this crew will hopefully make that happen. A friend of mine, Aaron, who's a part of this group and other groups that run down locations, she heard I was having trouble finding a spot from the TV show The Wire. And I had talked about it on a podcast once, and she's never been to Baltimore, which is where The Wire was filmed. And she contacted me yesterday. She's like, I think I found the spot, and the building has been since torn down, but from 3,000 miles away, she found the spot I had been looking for. So it's a brave new world, and for better or worse, but I think this is the right way to use this technology and connect with the past, because we have the archive, like I say in the Run DMC doc, we have the archive of all these pictures that you and other photographers took and have left us these sort of breadcrumbs. And now we go back and we try to find, like, is everything changed? Are some things the same? Where was the photographer standing? And like I said, we're really just trying to honor the photography and the photographer and the people that are in the pictures. It means a lot to us when we can make it all come together. So the fact that you have challenged the group with your grave digger shot, I think that's amazing. It was also,
this should be run on my website for people if they want.
I can picture it. It's fantastic. I mean, even when people see the doc that Nick is working on now, it's called In Search of David Corio, and we found you. But what they're going to see is, it's really special to have the photographer there, matching up angles and matching up spots and giving you insight and telling us how they felt when they took those pictures and what they were thinking and what it was like, because it's rare. We don't always have that opportunity. So right, thank you for that. You know, that's incredible.
No, not at all. One other thing, I mean, you know, you were saying about people contacting you, and I mean, I quite often get, you know, young photography students or whatever emailing or, you know, whatever, contacting me, just asking for advice. And I think, you know, that's something that what you're doing is good for people to, you know, sort of getting into photography. And that, I always say to people to look at, you know, look at old photographs, look at classic photo, you know, photograph, not music necessarily, but, you know, classic photographers, and look at their work and try and work out how they actually took the picture, you know. So, you know, did they use a wide angle lens? Did they use telephoto? What would the, you know, aperture have been? Were they, you know, sort of low? Were they high up? You know, were they just, you know, try and sort of figure it out. Because I think it's the best way, or certainly one of the best ways of learning how to take good photographs, is to, you know, actually know, you know, when is a good time to use a, you know, wide angle lens, when is a good time to stand back, maybe use a telephoto lens, or, and, you know, exposure, play with exposures and stuff. And, you know, I think you can learn from looking at, you know, great photographers, you know, photo books, exhibitions and stuff. It's, you know, it's a great way of improving your own work. And you know, going to exhibitions, seeing, you know, good photographs is, you know, just sort of really, rather than just look at them quick, really study them and think, you know, how did they do that? What position were they in? What type of film were they using? You know, same with, you know, being in a dark room as well. You learn way much more than I think, you know, having a digital camera. If you go back, learn how to develop film, and learn how to print, is, you know, it's a great way of improving your photography, you know. And likewise, you know, sort of showing the photographs and what the locations actually look like now, is, you know, that's a good tool as well, just to sort of see, you know, why did someone choose there and not, you know, 10 yards over there or something. You know, it's, you know, I think that is, it's, it all improves, you know, people's potential ability anyway, to, you know, compose pictures and make something, you know, stand out a bit more than just an average, you know, snap anyway. So,
for sure. Yeah. Well, Nick, did you have anything else you wanted to share or ask?
There's one thing I was going to ask, and apologies if it ends up being a bigger question, but hopefully it won't be. When you're actually, so there's one thing that's really kind of curious, because like some of the pictures of that you've taken that me and Andy have talked about previously, so the pictures of like of the Juice Crew, but also of PE. Now, you've taken those pictures in very, what's the best way, un-hip hop location in London, so like Hyde Park in Kensington, but the pictures really work well. I mean, what is it that you're looking for when you're taking a picture, in terms of, are you just looking for like some texture in the background or anything like that? You're not trying to necessarily, you know, you weren't taking those pictures because you were like, yeah, these guys are from South Kensington, so this is
right. Right, no, I mean, it's with those, I mean, the where they, it was basically it's where they were, you know, where they were staying, and knowing that I've got like 20 minutes, you know, with Public Enemy, I had probably about 20 minutes or something like that with them, and they were staying in a little hotel over the road. So it wasn't sort of like, oh, you know, there's no graffiti walls or anything like that there. So, you know, I've just got to get them, I don't, you know, sort of create shapes, basically, you know, is probably what I prefer, you know. So not, it shouldn't really matter too much what the location is, you know, in a way. It's like you want people to be focused on them anyway. So so it's really quite different when you've got like half a dozen people in a picture compared to one. You know, you can move around and, you know, focus on one person. When you've got six or seven of them, you know, then just trying to get them all to concentrate, and just you probably got them, you know, 5 minutes max where they're actually going to be, you know, with it before they start getting distracted or whatever. That Public Enemy one was fun, actually, because that was their first time in England, and they'd arrived the night before, and they said to me, they hadn't seen any McDonald's when they'd driven in from Heathrow Airport. They were staying in the West End of London, and they hadn't seen any sort of McDonald's food place at all. And they asked me, like, seriously, you know, it's like, can you buy a hamburger here? But it was like almost, you know, they thought that they probably didn't exist, you know, that there wasn't any McDonald's or anywhere, you know, like, what else are we going to eat, sort of thing, you know? So it was a very sort of incongruous sort of location, that, but it was, you know, it's more often than not, it's like time, and you're not going to be able to, if you're shooting, they're on a press junket, you know, so they're doing 20 interviews that day. So it's like, you've got to be quick, you know, and you've got to just sort
of... The thing I love about it is there's kind of like, you know, like in creative writing courses where you have to write a story, but you get given like little roadblocks that you're not allowed to kind of help increase creativity. Well, I feel the same way about the pictures you take of, like, certainly New York famous hip hop acts in London, because you're right that none of the record labels, certainly record labels in the time, aren't in, like, you know, kind of...
Yeah,
neighborhoods, they're all in posh neighborhoods. So in order for you to take a picture that you can't rely on, like stereotypes or anything like that. As you said, if you mentioned graffiti, you can't take a picture against a graffiti wall. You know, you're not taking a picture against like a big kind of stage or anything like that. So you really do have to kind of lead with what you feel is the strongest thing. And as you said, you know, getting that performance or getting that reaction or getting that pose from the person you're taking a picture of is where your creativity is going then, because, you know, you're kind of not, you're not thinking about the fact it's Kensington behind you. You're just thinking about what's happening right in front of.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, more often than not, if I'm shooting for magazines or papers, you know, it's going to be, the photograph is going to be maybe cut down to, you know, a few inches square or something, you know, so you need something with impact for it to, you know, to still pop off the page, you know, ideally anyway, you know. So it's, that's either the strength of the personality you're photographing, but, you know, it certainly helps if you can, you know, get a good shot. You know, more often than not, it has to be pretty sort of tight and close anyway. So, you know, that does sort of affect your judgment to an extent, certainly, as well. Yeah. But,
and the youth crew, and it's probably something we would never consider at the time, but now any documentary about any single member uses your photographs. Like, I was looking, again, I was doing research, I was going through, like, you know, this DVD Beef, and there was something I got off an AMC series, which I got, which are talking about, like, the kind of like MC beefs from that kind of era. They all just use your photographs. Every single documentary I watched, it went to your photographs. It was like it's just amazing that you had so little time with them, and you're in a place that was so challenging. And it's, in a way, for me anyway, it'd be difficult to kind of look at those locations and think, oh, I know what I'm going to do. But they became,
right, yeah,
they became the iconic pictures of those artists.
Right. Well, thank you. Yeah. No, I mean, it was, you know, a question of, well, it was just luck in a lot of ways, I guess, you know, and just, and also, you know, sort of dealing with people, I think, as well, you know, because, I mean, sometimes I don't really know how other photographers work, you know, I mean, everyone's got their own sort of way of working. I tend to let people do whatever they want to do, you know, I don't really give them any direction at all, you know, really. I mean, and some people, you know, barely speak to. I'll just sort of move around people a bit and shoot them. Or if they want to, you know, you can tell normally when people are into sort of chatting. I mean, so, you know, Marley Marl was good. Big Daddy Kane, you just knew, you know, he was just solid and silent. You know? same with, I shot Eric B and Rakim, and you know, like you know, sort of the Hilton fancy hotel room, and you know, Rakim was really nice, and you know, was sort of good to shoot. Eric B was motionless. I mean, he just didn't move, and I was, you know, moving the camera around him, and he was just staring straight ahead, didn't say a word the entire time I was shooting him, you know. But I mean, he had that presence about him that was, you know, good for pictures, but, you know, not for variety of pictures, put it that way.
It's good because you're taking what it is they're offering. Yeah, they're taking what it is they're kind of giving you, and kind of going, right, that's what I'm working with.
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
It makes sense, because you can't teach Biz Markie how to be Biz Markie.
Right, know? No, exactly, yeah. You know, no, definitely not, yeah. But, you know, his personality, you know, that comes over, I think, anyway, in those pictures. And, you know, the same with Big Daddy Kane. You know, he's sort of very serious and, you know, looks sort of hard and heavy, but, you know, he might be a teddy bear for all I know. But, I mean, it seemed to, you know, that was the image he wanted to convey anyway. So so I think, you know, it worked that way anyway.
You've met Big Daddy Kane, Andy, haven't you? Was he a big teddy bear to you?
He was great. He was pretty talkative, and he was friendly, and he actually ended up buying one of my paintings. I painted him his family. He commissioned me for a family portrait. So I've had some very good experiences with the Juice group. And I vouch for that. Yeah.
Maybe I caught him on a moody day, or it was a, well, yeah, it might have been a bit
you
early. Know,
the other thing I think of all the time too is that, like you said, with PE, it was their first time going overseas, and they're jet lagged, and they're disoriented. Maybe they don't know where they are, and that's a factor, I'm sure too. And then
there's
people that don't generally like to have their picture taken. That's a whole other element. But I think it's pretty amazing. You know, after you did the PE shots, they ended up going and recording the beginning of their It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back album that was recorded live at Hammersmith Odeon. So, that's the same trip. You know, that's history right there for people like you. Love that. I mean, that's so significant. And you're looking for a hamburger joint.
Yes. Yeah. I photographed that show as well. That was a great show. It was really good.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. They had those sort of hip hop packages back then. So there were a few that sort of came over, where it'd be like LL Cool J, Eric B, and Public Enemy, Beastie Boy. I missed the Beastie Boys somehow, but, you know, so some good sort of packages, you know, hip hop packages came over then anyway. But still, so if I could just give a quick plug to my website. And
read my mind. I was going to ask you. Yes.
Please. Oh, you were right. Okay.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Well, it's just davidcorio.com is the website. And in the hip hop section, there's that Gravediggers picture. So if anyone wants to have a look, it'll be on one of the pages. And then my Instagram is just at david.corio. Spelled Corio. And later this year, I've got a book being republished, coming out by a company in LA. The book's called The Black Cord, and it's photographs of a lot of my black musicians that I've photographed over the years. And it's sort of trying to link basically how all different black music has influenced each other. So it's sort of using my photographs. So, and this text by Vivian Goldman, a fairly well-known music writer and lecturer. And that should be coming out in about September this year anyway. So The Black Cord, with a foreword by the late great Isaac Hayes anyway. So
you also have some work in New York right now at the I'm not going to say the name of the museum properly, but it's a photography museum, correct?
Yeah, I think it's Fotografiska is the way it's pronounced. It's a Swedish company, but yeah, they've got a big gallery in New York on 22nd Street and Park Avenue South.
And it's a hip-hop show specifically?
Yeah, it's 50 years of their sort of claim, and I don't really know how you decide when hip-hop started, but they're saying this year is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of hip-hop. So yeah, they've got that the De La Soul picture of mine in there, and Fat Boys, and one of Marley Marl, actually, from that shoot.
Excellent.
That we all did together, yeah. So it's meant to be a good exhibition. I haven't seen it myself, but it looks good anyway.
Yeah, I want to get up there and see that. Do you know when it ends or how long it's running?
It's on. I think it's on for a few months, certainly. So I think till like May or June, something like that. So yeah, it's on for a while.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I have one more thing to shout out myself. I'm glad you plugged your website and your Instagram and your book. I'm looking forward to getting that. Jimmy asked me to remind everybody sort of how we all got started with the Outsider's House in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Danny Boy O'Connor, loving the movie and buying the house, turning it into a museum, and inspired us all. And that's where this podcast came from, to mission statements. And hopefully soon we can sort of celebrate the release of this new documentary that Nick's going to put out called In Search of David Corio. And it would be amazing if somehow we could figure out a way to celebrate that in person together, or maybe on another call like this. But
yeah,
there are some loose plans that might bring me to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the Outsider's House, because that's how all of this got started. So check out Mission Statements podcast and check out the Outsider's House. It's pretty inspiring stuff, and it's brought us all together in lots of different ways, and that's why we're here right now together talking about it. So thank you, and unless there's anything else, I'm gonna wrap it up and let you go on your merry way.
All right, it sounds good. No, definitely. Well, that was good fun. Enjoyed that, and look forward to seeing the movie, Nick, as well.
Yeah, they should be coming out very soon. I reckon 10 days. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much, David.
All right. No problem. Okay. Talk to you soon.
All right. Good night. Bye. Good night.